Lecture 9, The Uses of Irony.
Welcome back. Today's lecture is going to be on the subject of irony. And I will start by saying that there's something a little bit foolish about this, because talking about irony or trying to explain irony is like trying to explain humor. This is an academic subject. What makes something funny? Well, that'll put you to sleep very fast. We're like trying to explain the punchline of a joke to somebody who just doesn't get it. Once you explain it, it's no longer funny. Having said that, I will now proceed to tell you why things are ironic. This is a subject that everybody knows in his or her gut something about, though, of course, it's a bit slippery. And I'm also reminded of a famous remark made sometime in the 70s by Justice Potter Stewart on the Supreme Court. They were hearing a pornography case at the time, and they had to come up with a working definition of pornography in order to come to some decision about this case. And Mr. Potter Stewart said, "I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it." And that's something I suppose we all know about humor and jokes and irony. The same goes for irony. We know it when we hear it. By one definition, irony, of course, is saying one thing and meaning another. Or more extensively, I suppose it's a way of undermining with a word or a nod or a tone of voice something that you've said before or something you've said simultaneously. Some of the poems I talked about in the last class, the last lecture, the poem by Hardy or Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, could easily have been included in this category. And also with relation to other higher forms of irony, cosmic irony. That's what we find in Hardy and also in Greek tragedy. Oedipus is a case of cosmic irony, or conversational irony of the sort we find in Plato's dialogues, the dialogues of Socrates, where we have two opposing points of view sort of working against one another in a verbal sparring match to reach a truth or an understanding of a philosophical point. And in fact, the very word irony comes from the Greek term iron. So we would spell it E-I-R-O-N. An iron is what Socrates is, a dissimulator, a person who pretends not to know anything. Socrates, of course, is famous as being the wisest man in Athens because he claims to be entirely ignorant. And if you think of him as an early version of somebody like Jimmy Stewart in a Frank Capra movie, shuffling his feet and saying, "Well, I don't really know anything," of course, and he's the one who ends up knowing everything and wiping up the floor with his opponents. The opponent would be called in Greek the alazon, the braggart, the big blowhard. So we have Socrates saying to, well, whoever it is, Euthyphro or Thrasymachus, "Gee, you're so smart, you tell me what justice means." And then, of course, that's the end of Euthyphro or Thrasymachus. I want to start by looking at some of the means and the reasons for producing an ironic effect in a poem. And let's begin with some really sweet is the wrong word, but certainly persuasive, brittle pieces of irony in two short poems by Dorothy Parker. The first is called Unfortunate Coincidence. The second is called Resume. Dorothy Parker's facile cynicism, the cynicism of all of those people from the Algonquin, is easy to sense. It's easy to get. It's very difficult to explain, and it's even more difficult to produce. These two famous short lyrics are, of course, both very funny and very sad. And the first thing to be said about irony is that there is a great relationship between sadness and sarcasm. It's an intimate relationship. Oscar Wilde once defined a cynic as a man who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. So this is where irony, I think, comes from. Here is Unfortunate Coincidence. By the time you swear you're his, shivering and sighing, and he vows his passion is infinite, undying, lady, make a note of this. One of you is lying. The charm, can we use that word? The charm of this poem derives in part from the very exaggerated, or no, the slightly exaggerated diction. It's a pastiche of all of those old Petrarchan notions of romantic love, and the fact that there is a continuous sentence, and the alternation of what we call masculine and feminine line endings, stressed syllables, unstressed syllables, sighing, undying, lying, those are what we call feminine endings. And of course, then the punch delivered by the last line. Make a note of this, one of you is lying. It's a wonderful way of using the last line to counter, to balance, to undermine everything that preceded it.